You may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Edward Stein. I'm the Commonwealth Attorney of Allegheny County, appointed by the court as Special Prosecutor for the people of Montgomery County, appearing here today on behalf of the Commonwealth of Virginia, asserting that the Circuit Court of Montgomery County erred in its interpretation of Code Section 24.2233-6. The gravamen of this case is the interplay between 24.2233 and 24.2235. Now, what these are statutes that are, quite frankly, very rarely used in the Commonwealth of Virginia, but they are vitally important because they are the only statutes that allow the citizens of a jurisdiction to remove an elected official for what we will, in general terms, call malfeasance in office between elections. And that's important here because the petition here was brought to remove the clerk of Montgomery County, who had just started an eight-year term. So absent this statute, the people of Montgomery County, if the clerk is not performing her duties, would essentially have no remedy for when this petition was brought for 8 years.
Why would they have no remedy? All they have to do, if they're making an accusation as a petitioner, is to say, I really believe it's true, and I'm willing to stand up and say under oath it's true.
Well, that is what happened here, Your Honor. People did sign the petition under oath.
So people can sign petitions, become petitioners, but actually not verify that the words of the petition are accurate. They can just say, well, someone says it's accurate, and if it is accurate, I agree that the person should be removed.
Well, the issue here is not the Commonwealth does not assert that no one needs to sign the petition under oath. The Commonwealth asserts that every person who signs the petition, the 233 requirement, that 10% of the elected official, of the registered voters from the last election, that all of those people do not need to sign under oath. And what the Commonwealth asserts is what we have is a balloting test. The General Assembly did not want to make it too easy and say what the Commonwealth is not alleging, that any person can just come to court and sign a petition. But also is not the intent of the General Assembly to make it too hard, set the burden so high to make it near impossible. And Commonwealth is going to focus this argument on the Attorney General opinion that cited from 1989 interpreting that statute, which does exactly that and crafts that balance.
Can I ask
Attorney
you this?
General says this.
This court, though, said in the Malbin case that these proceedings are highly penal in nature, even though they're not criminal proceedings, and that therefore they should be strictly construed. So if there's two reasonable ways to read it, and I'm not conceding there is, but if there are two reasonable ways to read it, isn't that the end of the game right there? The thumb is on the scale against you.
No, sir, because the Malvern case does set that standard. But the Malvern case also says in the same paragraph that these statutes shall be construed to conform to the legislative intent. The legislative intent here being to provide a remedy for the removal of officials.
Well, the legislative intent is expressed through the words, because other than an AG opinion, I don't see anybody saying that you can sign a petition without verifying that what you're signing is true and you're standing behind it. So if you're inferring it, you're going to be using something outside the text of the statute. And we generally don't do that when we see the word strict construction attached to the standard of review of the statutory scheme.
The Commonwealth would have two responses to that, Your Honor. Number one is we're not just relying on the Attorney General's opinion, because what the court has said in a number of cases, Deal versus Commonwealth, and in Stanley versus Commonwealth, which decided on brief, what this court has said is when the Attorney General has rendered an opinion and time has gone by and the General Assembly, having looked at the statute, which in this case they've done several times, in fact actually recodifying it because the Attorney General's opinion was under Title 24.1, and we're now under 24.2, and if the court compares the text that set forth the Attorney General opinion to what's in the text now, when they recodified it, they actually cleaned, other than make any real substantive changes, they clearly looked at the language and made some language changes.
Excuse me, are you saying that you are asserting that there are substantive changes between 24.1 and 24.2?
There are certainly changes, and I don't think that what the court has said necessarily means that it has to be a substantive change. There certainly have been changes to the statute.
Because the General Assembly typically does not make substantive changes when they recodify, when they go from one code title to a new code.
Unless
they specifically say that they are doing so in the report that accompanies it.
Well, the language is not the same, and we can assume that the General
Assembly... It rarely is in a recodification. That's why a recodification occurs.
Again, Your Honor, there are certainly changes in the language, whether they're substantive or not. There are language that the General Assembly decided needed to be made, and then even subsequent to that, and while it's not in 233 or 235, the last amendment was actually 238, which is within the same article, and actually is relevant because it actually goes to the heart of who's responsible for these petitions. And, 30 years has passed since that general, since the Attorney General, 28 years since the Attorney General has issued that opinion. We presume that the General Assembly is well aware of it. And when 28 years have gone by, the General Assembly, having looked at these statutes, has not made any changes, then we can presume that they acquiesce in what the Attorney General's opinion was. And that's important here, not only for the legal point, but Commonwealth would assert it for very practical reasons, because this is a statute that is designed to be used by lay people. This is not a statute written for lawyers. This is a statute that essentially gives a fundamental right. It's the right of the people to petition for redress of grievances. And it's designed for when people are not happy with an elected official, for them to be able to get this case in court.
But the council, of the vast majority of the signatures on that first form, they didn't. It didn't even include any grounds for removal, did it, beyond a recitation of the statutory grounds?
Well, the issue came up in circuit court. Were we dealing with one form or two forms? And what the circuit court ruled was that all of those pieces of paper are to be read together. That, in fact, was one petition. That was the ruling of the circuit court. That ruling was appealed to this court, and the writ on that issue, that issue of cross appeal, was denied by the writ panel. So that's the law, as far as we're concerned here, of this case, is that all of those documents ought to be read together.
So which is part of the problem, because people can sign a lot of things having no idea what they're signing, but the moment you tell them, if you're signing this and there's a serious penalty if you're saying something that's untrue, they'll think about it before they sign it. So how do we know that the signatures that are not signed under penalty of perjury is someone saying, look, I have no idea what the person did or didn't do, but I don't like them and I want them out? Because that's clearly not what the statute's meant to permit.
I think the statute is meant to make sure that someone is willing to take responsibility for these petitions. And in this case, we had 50 someones. There were at least 50 people who were willing to come forward and sign it under oath.
Is one person enough?
Commonwealth's assertion would be yes.
So one person can make accusations under oath, factual accusations of malfeasance, and 10,000 people can sign it having no personal knowledge whatsoever of whether that's true or false. And that's okay with you?
Well, yeah. I would give more credit to the citizens of this Commonwealth maybe than the court would. Because the Attorney General said there were numerous protections put into this statute. Number one, you still have to have 10% of the registered voters who voted for that office. Now, depending on the jurisdiction, that may be a very small or a very large number. Certainly, if we're talking about Montgomery County, if we're going to bigger jurisdictions, if we're talking about Virginia Beach or Fairfax, we're talking about an extraordinarily large number of people being that 10%.
But it's still smaller than the 51% that put the person there in the first place.
It is. But the petition does not remove anyone from office. The petition alleges that that grounds exist for the court to issue a show cause, with the idea that this is like any other than civil proceeding. The court can look at the facts. If there are not factual allegations sufficient, the court can grant a demur. If the court feels it's sufficient, then we have a trial. As the court has said, given the prior case law, the petitioners would have to decide by clear and convincing evidence, which is a fairly high standard, that the malfeasance has occurred. And quite frankly, this is a problem that, this statute has been on the books since the late 1800s, at least. This has not been a real problem, because As far as the Commonwealth can determine...
The one elected official on January 9th, 2018, it is a real problem, and that's why we're here.
Yeah, but there have been very few cases brought under the statute. As far as the Commonwealth has determined, every case the Commonwealth has determined has been determined, it's been interpreted the way the Commonwealth is interpreting it here. That has not been interpreted to mean that every person needs to sign it under oath. And in fact, the 1919 version of this statute, which I believe is 27, Code Section 2705, at that point said that a court could bring this type of action on its own motion with no petitioner, or at that time, 1919, it said one person, didn't even have to be a registered voter, one person residing in the jurisdiction could bring such an action. So we've come a long way from 1919.
Thank the Lord.
Yes, sir.
But now, if you had less than 10% of the voting population, would that be sufficient for a petition?
If we didn't have 10% of the
registered... Less than 10%.
No, sir. I think 233 makes it clear.
So what does it mean to make a petition? If it's not sufficient to file it, isn't the 10% of the voters part of making the petition? And if so, the statute talks about making the petition under oath. So what does making mean?
The Commonwealth takes the position that when the General Assembly uses different words in the different sections, they mean different things. And that's part of the Commonwealth's argument, that in 233, where you say 10% of the registered voters must sign, and then say when 235, when it says the people making the petition must do so under oath, that they are in fact referring to two different sets of people. When they say making, they are not referring just to the people signing the petition. They are actually referring to the makers.
So can less than 10% of the electorate make a petition? That's effective.
The Commonwealth position is that one person can make the petition. They can write up the petition. They can circulate the petition. They would sign it under oath.
So you think make in this particular instance means to author, to draft?
Yes.
So someone who signs a petition is not a petitioner. Because a petitioner is someone who's making a petition. I'm petitioning you. Therefore, I'm a petitioner. But... is it true, Judge Kelsey, what these allegations are? Oh, I have no idea personally, but I'm not making a petition. I thought you said you were a petitioner. I am a petitioner. I'm petitioning to have her removed. But you're not making one. No. Does that conversation make sense to you?
It does in the context of this case. And, and we look at Johnson versus Woodward. While it's not directly on point, Johnson versus Woodward is important because the gravamen of that case was who's responsible for this petition?
The petitioners, right?
There were actually 40 people, not all the people, not the registered voters, only 40 people in that case were sanctioned. And what the court said was the petitions were signed by the petitioners and were also signed by 10% of the registered voters. Well, that's why there were petitioners and then there were 10% of the registered voters. Those were different sets of people. And in response to the Johnson case, the court amends the statute, comes in and adds a paragraph 238 to get out of the idea of individuals being responsible. And what do they say in 238? In fact, the Commonwealth will admit that this body muddies the water more than it clarifies it, because then they say, having talking about signatures and petitioners and makers, now in 238 they add B, which says no person who signs a petition or who circulates such a petition. So now we've added the people who circulate it. Now, the Commonwealth, again, would say that the people who are circulating it are essentially, in most cases, going to be the makers. And, every 4 years, I have to circulate petitions to get back on the ballot. People sign those petitions they're saying, I'm a registered voter. I agree that this person should be on the ballot.
But they're not making a petition to put you on the ballot? That's not what they're doing.
They are making a petition to put me on the ballot, but they are not alleging under oath that I'm eligible to be a candidate.
Did you say they are making a petition?
They are signing a petition. No,
but they're not making a petition.
I am petitioning to get on the ballot. They are signing that petition. They are not responsible for the representations that I'm a registered voter, that I'm over 18, that I've lived in the jurisdiction for 6 months, they're not responsible for
that. Why should they be making a petition if those things are not something they know to be true?
I think they can believe them to be true without having to verify under oath, Your Honor.
Okay, so they're like cross their fingers behind their back when they say that?
They are saying somebody else is going to come behind me and double check. In my case, the editorial board, in the case of these petitions, a circuit court judge or a jury is going to ultimately decide whether the facts are true or not, Your Honor. I see my time's up.
It has. Let me just ask you one last question. There are 50 voters that signed a different form under penalty of perjury. Where did that form come from?
All of the forms were circulated together, Your Honor. And again,
so where did it come from?
They were drafted by the maker and circulator.
Created for the occasion.
Pardon?
Created for
yes,
the
sir.
Occasion.
All there right. were people Thank who went out.
All right. Thank you very much.
May it please the court. My name is Jennifer Royer, and it is my pleasure to represent Erica Williams, the clerk of the Circuit Court for Montgomery County, in these proceedings. As this court is well aware, petitions for removal in the Commonwealth are highly penal in nature, and for that reason, they are subject to strict scrutiny. The petition for removal in this case was dismissed by the trial judge because it was not signed by 10% of the number of registered voters who cast votes in the last election of the circuit court under penalty of perjury.
Let me ask you this. We have two offsetting canons of construction. We have the penal one, which favors your side, and we have the AG one, which we've said multiple times. Construction of the Attorney General, unless General Assembly changes it, is binding. We even said that. Which column should we draw from and why?
You should absolutely consider that in terms of statutory construction, when we have statutes that are so highly penal in nature, that strict construction is required. Now, the opinion from 1989 by the Attorney General is just that. It's an opinion. And I understand the position of the Commonwealth that the statute had been amended and in one instance at least recodified since that opinion had been handed down. But an attorney general is not a legislator. The attorney general is not a judge. And the
right.
attorney
if
general
we're writing
is not
on a blank slate, that's what the direction I would take, which is we give it respectful consideration and that's it. But we have those cases that say once there's an official opinion, that's a fairly elaborate process. And then it comes out, that's binding. So I'm just trying to figure out, I mean, you say what's persuasive only, but that's not what our cases say. So how do we pick a dispositive canon of construction?
I think that the language of the cases is that once there's an attorney general opinion that has been handed down, the General Assembly is deemed to have knowledge of that opinion and has acquiesced in the construction of that opinion. I don't necessarily know that that means it is binding on this court. Okay. The decision or the statutory interpretation or, the intent of the General Assembly in passing the bill at the first instance is not necessarily binding on this court. This court can, of course, determine that a statute is unconstitutional or a statute as applied under certain circumstances should not be applied in that way. And I would say that under these circumstances, we look at an attorney general opinion as being persuasive authority and certainly not binding on this court in terms of how the court interprets these statutes. Now, if we look at the statutes in issue here, we have three, and we have to look
when
at the...
When we look at 235, 235 seems to indicate that there can be one maker, and of course that's referring back to 234, but if there can be one maker under 235, and you read that in conjunction with 233, wouldn't that indicate one maker and 10% signers?
No.
Why not?
Let me go back to looking at 233 and the interplay of these three statutes together. The key to interpreting these statutes is to look at, first of all, who or what office does the official in issue hold? Is it an elected office, or is it an office that is appointed for a term under the law? That's one issue. The second issue is, how did that person get into that office? If it's an elected official, that's one avenue. If it's an appointed official, that's another avenue. And if you look at Section 233 deals with elected officials who were filling an elected term. And Section 234 deals with appointed
officials.
Doesn't
233 deal with certain appointed officials?
It does, Your Honor. But specifically, it deals with officials who are appointed to fulfill an elected term. So, for example, if somebody is elected into office and has to step down or is promoted to a different position or whatever the case may be, if there is a body that's assigned under the law of fulfilling that vacancy, that's an appointment of an elected official or official who would otherwise hold elected office. So again, we go back to what is the nature of the office that this official holds? Is it one that in the ordinary course would be filled by election, or is it one in the ordinary course that would be filled by appointment? And by appointment, let me give you by way of example, school board members in certain city jurisdictions. For example, the city of Martinsville appoints its school board members by the city council. It's not an elected office in Martinsville. So those officials, if you were to remove a school board member in the city of Martinsville, for example, you would have to proceed under Section 234. You could not proceed under Section 233. Now, in some instances, there are offices where a vacancy could be filled by appointment by perhaps one person. And if there is that situation where one person appoints someone into that office, that appointed office, then in that situation, the maker of the petition would be the one person who had authority to make that appointment. Or, for example, in my example with the City of Martinsville School Board, it would be the majority of the City Council.
So a 233 person who is one appointing authority would not need 10%.
Under 233, the elected official, in order to remove an elected official under 233, you absolutely need 10% of the registered voters from the prior election for that office. And that's where the distinction really lies in this case. We're looking at statutory construction, and we have to read these statutes together in a way that makes sense. 233 applies to elected officials. 234 applies to appointed officials, and 235 provides the procedure under which...
So what part of 233 applies to 234? It says under the provisions of 24.2, 233. 234 references back to 233.
Yes, ma'am. And Your Honor, it refers back to the grounds for removal that are set forth in 233. 233 has a list of grounds for removal, including certain criminal actions, sex offenses, hate crimes, drug offenses, and the one that this case falls under, which is the misuse of office, failure to perform duties, neglect of duties, that section. So 234 pulls from 233 those grounds for removal.
It doesn't refer to grounds for removal. It just sort of generally refers to may be removed from office under the provisions of 24.2. One of the provisions of 24.2233. One of the provisions of 233 is 10%.
You're not reading it wrong, Your Honor. The problem is this is not a statute that's necessarily well written. I will concede that. However, it is a statute that has to be harmonized. And to the extent that there could be an ambiguity in the interpretation of these statutes, that's what the courts are called upon to do, to read them in a way so as to give meaning to all the words so that no language is rendered superfluous and no language is rendered meaningless. If you look at 233, which is very clearly related to the elected officials and officials who are appointed to fulfill an elected office, it says here are the reasons why you can petition the court for removal. At the bottom, it says the petition has to be signed by a number of registered voters who reside within the jurisdiction equal to 10% of the number of total votes cast in the last election. And then you go to 234. 234 is the removal of officers appointed for a certain term, or term certain. And yes, it does pull from 233. It pulls the grounds for removal from 233 so as not to incorporate them again. And it does state in here that, you know, that the makers of the petition under 234 can be one person or the majority of the authority that has the ability to appoint that person. And really, that's where the two statutes differ. The two statutes differ because we're looking at, one, 233 elected officials or persons who are appointed to fill an elected office, 234 appointed officials for a term certain. And 235 is your procedure. If you read them in that way, elected officials who are elected by the populace, You need 10%, because it's not sufficient for one person to be able to sign a petition and say, I don't think that person did their job, let me try to remove them from office. You need enough voters to know what's going on in the jurisdiction in order to be able to make a reasonable determination as to whether or not this is a petition that's grounded in fact. And so one person should not be able to overturn an election. And that's what this interpretation that's being proffered by the Commonwealth would permit to happen.
Let me ask you this.
Yes,
looking at 235, it says the petition has to state with reasonable accuracy and detail the grounds or grounds for removal. So someone has to craft that petition.
That's correct.
Someone. And so, you know, it's not just not going to generate itself. So typically there's going to be one or several activists who are fired up about alleged or real malfeasance. And so they're drafting it. And another way of saying that is simply they're making it. They're the ones crafting the petition. The voter at large isn't essentially doing this bill of indictment. So then, immediately following, you have to state with reasonable accuracy the grounds for removal has to be signed by the person making it under penalty of perjury. Then you look at the language in 233, petition has to be signed. It doesn't say signed under oath. So we're saying any voter who simply says, you know, that's a sufficient concern for me, it ought to go to a hearing, they now have to sign under oath. And I'm just having a hard time importing the phrase under oath in 233 when 235 seems to target those particular individuals who are really the moving force and the crafters of the petition for removal. That's, maybe you can help me with that interpretive dilemma.
Well, let me try looking at it this way. The way that our judicial system is typically structured, a client comes into your office and tells you, I have a concern, I want to file a lawsuit. I, as the attorney, draft the petition. Under this analysis, that would make me the maker of the petition because I drafted the petition. That is not what these statutes mean. It doesn't encompass the person who actually sits down and puts their fingers on the keyboard and types the petition. The maker of the petition under 233 is the 10% of the populace who cast the vote in the preceding election. The maker of the petition under 234 is the person or majority of the body that appointed that person to elected office. And under the analysis that you gave, Your Honor, you said you were struggling with putting the under penalty of perjury language under 233. Well, if you look, it's not under 234 either, because neither 233 nor 234 set the procedures for the petition. 235.
Signing is making. That's your bottom line, right? Signing is making.
No, okay. No. The maker of the petition is or are, depending upon the number of people involved, are the ones who are coming forward to the tribunal and saying, I believe I have a grievance that needs to be heard. It's not the person who writes it. It's not. I sign the petitions on behalf of my client. That doesn't make me a maker. It's the person who has the grievance. It's the persons or the entities or the bodies that have the grievance that makes the maker. And under the statute, the maker for an elected official has to be 10% of the population. It's not sufficient for one person to stand before
a
tribunal.
To use your earlier analogy, if a client signs your pleading, your complaint, and you drafted it and just gave it to him and said, just sign it, and later it turns out that the pleading is frivolous, the client could never say to the court who is considering sanctions, well, I just signed it. I didn't make the darn thing.
That's a different analysis altogether, because as this court's aware, lawyers are under certain duties of professional responsibility with respect to ghostwriting pleadings. I can't just write a pleading and send off somebody on their merry way to do with it what they will. And if a person, let's suppose I sent a draft to a client, the client ghosts on me and then takes my work and files it without my consent with the court. By signing that, they are saying, I am the person, I am pro se in these situations, I'm not represented by counsel.
Yeah, but my point is that the client would never be able to say, I'm not responsible for verifying what this pleading said just because I signed the thing, because I just signed it. My lawyer made it. And in your analogy that you gave earlier, here the signers can't say, look, I'm not making this petition, I'm a petitioner, but I'm not making a petition. I don't know how that works, but But suppose they said that. So I can't verify any of this, what's been said here. I don't know. They would still be in the same category as a client signing a complaint that's frivolous, claiming that they cannot be sanctioned because they didn't make the complaint. They only signed it.
But our code has a requirement, or defines, rather, counsel of record, persons who would be subject to sanctions, defines counsel of record to include those individuals who go off pro se and file a pleading. Under this scenario, the biggest concern I think we have is you have one person saying, I promise this is true, and 1,800 other people who may or may not even know what they're signing. And that is why we have this.
I took Justice Kelsey's question to be a very, very friendly one to you.
I'm sorry.
I took Justice Kelsey's question to be very friendly, and I think you have taken it to be hostile. What he's saying is that when you sign it, you're a maker.
When you sign,
what you're saying.
I apologize, Your Honor.
Just go ahead.
When you sign the underlying petition, yes, you're a maker.
There you go.
When you sign the underlying petition, which is why it has to be under penalty.
Did we overspeak? Did we lose, in your opinion, use loose language in Johnson versus Woodard when we identified the 40, the petitions were signed by the petitioners and also were signed by 10% of the registered voters?
Your Honor, my time is up. Would you like me to
answer? Yes, please.
Yes, Your Honor. I don't think this issue was ever before this court in Johnson v. Woodard, because the underlying case in the Gloucester County was non-suited for the very reason that brings us to court today. That issue was never before this court. The language that's being referenced is dicta. It's not binding on this court or any other court. I don't know that the court had the benefit of the analysis of the argument that we're presenting here today, and so I don't think that there is anything in that specific language cited by Your Honor that would bind this court in how it construes these statutes going forward.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Call the next case.